Good morning. On today's programme, we hear about a shortage of cooking gas in Cameroon and about a project to document the impact of climate change on the Great Barrier Reef. But first we go to Germany, and this time of year marks an important anniversary for Germans. The Berlin Wall came down in early November 1989, and that led to the reunification of East and West Germany. This month also marks a Berlin Wall anniversary for one particular German man. Ronan Kelly met him lately near Berlin.
The old man told us a story about how his father had written to him on graph paper from a maths copybook and that his mother had sent him an orange. But I was struggling to take it all in. And that's because the dreadful stories the old man was telling didn't match the surroundings. It was late October in Germany and hot. So hot, the warm breeze drifting down the Potsdam Street was gently swishing the skirts on linen dresses and nudging jackets off. The old man's story was about the grim first days of the Berlin Wall, but he was sitting there, smiling, in a lemon-yellow jumper at a table outside a coffee shop. We were having Kaffee und Kuchen, that German treat, and he was pressing the side of his fork into the orange glaze on a slice of apricot cake. It was the apricots that prompted that memory of orange peel and maths paper from 60 years ago. He used the tips of his fingers to demonstrate how he had broken the peel into pieces and rolled them up to make tiny shapes of different sizes. A larger shape was a king, another was a queen, the smaller ones were bishops, knights, pawns, and so on. Using the bits of orange peel and the maths paper, the man had made a chess set and played every day with his cellmate. He told the story so well. He drew you out of the dazzling sunlit street and into the gloomy German prison cell. You could see the two prisoners sitting at a small table. The man had piled his chemistry textbooks up on the edge of the table so the chess set couldn't be seen from the peephole in the door. Then one day, Lothar and his cellmate were so engrossed in the game of chess that they didn't hear the guard opening the cell door quietly and coming in. Those of us sitting listening to him outside the coffee shop gasped. Lothar said the guard grabbed the maths paper and bits of orange peel and shouted at them for breaking the rules. One of us said, "No." Then Lothar shrugged and made a, "Ah well," face. He did this a lot. He would tell a story and then at the end shrug and sometimes say the word, "Destiny." Like when he told us how he ended up in the prison. It was this time of the year, November 1961. Lothar was living in Berlin and working as a chemistry lecturer. The East German government had just closed the border with West Germany, but it had yet to become the Berlin Wall. In many places, it was still a wire fence. One of Lothar's students could see the fence from his flat, and he'd worked out that there was a 30-minute gap between each guard patrol. The plan was that a couple of students and their lecturer, Lothar, would wait until the guards passed and then cut through the fence and escape to the west. Lothar said they were cocky, and he showed us how they just ambled up to the fence with their wire cutters. Unfortunately, that night, the patrol routine changed and a new set of soldiers came around the corner and caught them. Lothar was sentenced to a year and 8 months in prison. The prison was right near where we were sitting having coffee, and it was called, ironically, the Linden Hotel. It's now a museum, and when Lothar brought us in, he was treated like a VIP. He joked with the staff that this was his first flat in Potsdam. He showed us the cells where he was kept, the room where he was questioned, and the reception room where his parents were allowed to meet him just before Christmas 1961. Lothar puts his hand on his heart as he remembers that, during this meeting, his mother broke down crying. Lothar's mother had particular reason to grieve. During the Second World War, when Berlin was being bombed by the Allies, she had made her way with her children, including 7-year-old Lothar, to the east, to the Polish border. Then later, when the Russians were advancing across Poland, she fled back to Berlin. And although her siblings had taken their families farther west to Bavaria, Lothar's mother said that she was a Berliner and would rather die in Berlin. It was an unfortunate decision, because when the wall went up, the rest of her family were all in West Germany, while she and her children were trapped in the east. Lothar shrugs. "Destiny," he says. As I say, he punctuates his stories with this a lot, a shrug and the word destiny. For instance, I mentioned that I had eaten in a lunch place in the old Jewish quarter of Berlin, and he smiled broadly and said that he had lived on the same street. In fact, he said when he was 9, they were living there as the Russians entered Berlin. That was such a dangerous time for German women. Hundreds of thousands of them were raped by Russian soldiers, and I wondered about Lothar's mother being attacked. He said that his family were lucky. They were living in a cellar at the back of a large building. The front of the building had been destroyed by a Russian bomb, and the Russians thought the whole place was ruined and that no one had survived in there. After 2 weeks, Lothar's mother let him go out and wander around. He saw tanks and dead bodies and Russian soldiers cooking goulash. They gave him some, which he brought back to his family. Eventually, they all emerged and were unharmed by the Russians. Destiny, shrugs Lothar. Back in the Linden Hotel prison reception room, Lothar recalled first that one kindly guard told his crying mother not to worry, that it's never as bad as it seems. And he was right. Because so many East Germans were trying to flee to the West, the prison soon became overcrowded, and to make space, Lothar was released after 8 months. After that, life behind the wall was easier for Lothar than other East Germans. He could at least get out every so often. He got his job as a research scientist back, and as such, he could travel to international conferences. His family in the West were able to send him food and money, and later he could visit there once a year. But when he talks about international travel, Lothar puts his hand up to his mouth. I didn't like saying I was German when I was abroad. So much hatred for what we had done. But I wasn't responsible. And now, he said, there's more hatred for people coming to live here. He's talking about refugees, climate refugees too. And then the colours and the sunshine and the unseasonable heat do match the conversation. Because we start talking about survival, something Lothar has been referring to in terms of his past, but now he talks about in terms of the future. You know, he says, for me, it's okay, I'm 86. But my granddaughters, with the climate, this will be the tropics. It's terrible. And for the first time, he doesn't shrug and doesn't say the word destiny.
That was Ronan Kelly reporting from Berlin. We take you to Cameroon next, where there's been a national shortage of cooking gas. Many Cameroonians have now been forced to rely on traditional alternatives, such as charcoal, sawdust pots and 3-stone cooking fires, just to survive. Dorcas Akupe reports now from the far north of Cameroon.
It is a particular sunny afternoon in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, and desperate Ndeye Cindy is perched on her gas bottle. Cindy fishes out a plastic bag of flour pancakes from her handbag and bites. She tells us this could be her only meal for the day if she doesn't succeed to get cooking gas. She says she's gone 2 weeks without gas. Cindy says she once waited for 4 days for kerosene and still didn't get anything. Everyone is suffering. What can we do? She voiced out to World Report with a worried look. Cooking gas has been scarce for weeks in Cameroon. At sales points in some regions, long queues are formed by several weary residents. Like Ndeye Cindy, many others, including families, are gravely affected without this domestic gas. People cannot cook food and are forced to spend extra income to buy roadside food. For some families, that is simply a luxury they can't afford, so they go hungry. It's not just families that are affected by the shortage. Some sectors are seeing their businesses crumble. Mrs. Gladys, a food vendor, says she hasn't had any gas for 3 weeks, and when it's available, it's very expensive. She says it's hard to believe that gas that used to be sold for 6,500 francs, that is about 10 euros, is now sold at 15,000 francs, which is about 22 euros. Cooking gas has been scarce for months. To bypass the inconveniences caused by the scarcity of cooking gas, several families across the country have returned to conventional methods. The situation has become so difficult that charcoal and sawdust are increasingly popular to cook with in this region. Mrs. Eugene told World Report that she uses sawdust to warm water and make her kids breakfast due to scarcity of gas. To another city dweller, the use of sawdust pots is returning to homes again, and several people seem to be going back to the 90s when they cook just once a day because of no gas and the stress of handling sawdust pots. In the littoral region where the Central African nation's commercial capital, Douala, is located, it is the same story, with almost everyone on the street going from one selling point to another with 12.5 kilograms of empty gas cylinders in search of the cooking product. The fruitless search under the scorching sun have left many dismayed. While some have switched to other substitutes like charcoal and firewood, many others are still very helpless. A young man who prefers anonymity says given the state of his home, it is difficult to use traditional alternatives, and so coping without gas is therefore difficult. The Cameroon government has, however, not been too vocal about the issue, though efforts have been made to ensure cooking gas is available. Though Okeh Johnson, the Director General of the Hydrocarbons Prices Stabilization Fund, the body in charge of supplying gas, said on state television that about 4,000 bottles of cooking gas has arrived at the Douala port, and efforts will be made to ensure it is distributed to various retail gas stations of the country. However, many Cameroonians are still waiting for supplies to reach them. For World Report, this is Dorcas Ekupe in the far north of Cameroon.
Finally, we go to Australia, and one of the world's largest marine citizen science projects is underway on Australia's Great Barrier Reef. It's the third year that a flotilla of tourism vessels, dive boats, tugboats, super yachts and recreational vessels will document the impact of climate change, including coral bleaching caused by warmer sea temperatures and other threats to the 2,300-kilometre coral system. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
From space, there's only one living thing that can be seen. It's the Great Barrier Reef, arguably Australia's greatest natural treasure. This wonderland is made up of 3,000 individual coral reefs. It's home to a spectacular array of jellyfish, worms, fish, whales and dolphins. The world's largest coral system is under threat, but to recognise the dangers, researchers need information. This is where a fleet of boats, big and small, and legions of citizen scientists come in. They're part of the annual Great Reef Census. It began 3 years ago and is again helping to chart the well-being of the coral. Last year, 42,000 images from 315 individual reefs were collected during the survey. They were taken by volunteers and uploaded. They were then analysed by thousands of enthusiasts around the world who've looked for clues about the health of the reef off northeastern Australia. Experts say that some parts are flourishing. Others, though, are under siege from warmer ocean temperatures and more intense tropical storms, as well as coral-eating crown-of-thorn starfish. Warmer seas cause bleaching, forcing the coral to expel microscopic symbiotic algae that gives it most of its energy and colour. Reefs can recover from bleaching, but it can take years. If water temperatures don't return to normal, the coral can die. There have been several mass bleaching events in recent years. There are other threats too. The industrialisation and development of the Queensland coast have been a concern for conservationists. So has the runoff of pesticides and fertilisers from farms into the waters of the Great Barrier Reef. Overfishing has its consequences too. The surveillance project has become so big that artificial intelligence is being used to scan much of the data. It's a collaboration between Australian universities, charities, environmental organisations and the government. But in many ways, the engine room of this global project are people who probably have never been to Australia or even visited the Great Barrier Reef. Such is its international appeal that citizen scientists in many countries just want to be involved. Perhaps the reef is simply a monumental symbol of the hazards posed by climate change. The United Nations is assessing the impact of global warming on the reef. Earlier this year, a UN monitoring team continued its assessment as to whether it should be added to the list of World Heritage in Danger sites. Conservationists say that the most critical factor in efforts to protect this oceanic paradise is to curb emissions. Australia's reliance on coal and gas for most of its electricity has made it one of the world's worst per capita emitters of greenhouse pollution. For years, it's been regarded as a climate laggard. But that perception is now changing. For the first time, Australia has a legislated target to cut greenhouse gases. This year, under a new Labor government, new laws were passed that will cut carbon emissions by 43% by 2030. Campaigners say it's a good start, but they stress that much more needs to be done to relieve the pressure from climate change on the Great Barrier Reef. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.